London Lovers Chris and Partner Registry, Lesbian Cop's Widow Demands Pension Benefits, and Anti-Mugabe Activist Calls for Queer Attention to All Human Rights. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Kelly Blanchfield.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 8, 2001. Gay and lesbian couples officially registered their partnerships in the UK for the first time this week. Although the City of London's new registry has no legal standing, it's hoped that it may support couples when issues arise in areas such as tenancy, pensions, inheritance, and immigration. London Mayor Ken Livingstone, who made good on his campaign promise to create the registry, attended the ceremony and presented a bouquet to the first couple to register. They are Ian Burford and Alexander Cannell, who've been together for 38 years. They were followed by the first lesbian couple to register, Linda Wilkinson and Carol Budd, who've been together for 16 years. The London Partnership Register is also open to heterosexual couples. Registry at London's Town Hall comes at a cost of £85.
Although the London Registry is Britain's first, it's clear it won't be the last. Similar registries have already been proposed in the cities of Manchester, Liverpool, Brighton, and Hove. The Manchester bill is supported by all political parties in the city council and is expected to win final approval before the year is out. The Liverpool bill this week was sent to committee without discussion and is expected to die there. That was surprising because the Liverpool City Council is controlled by the Liberal Democrats, who have been vocal advocates at the national level for legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples. But openly gay Liverpool councillor Paul Brandt promised that his Labour Party would continue to press for the registry. Bills to recognize same-gender couples will be introduced in the British Parliament in October. This week, the Lord Chancellor's Department announced that its plans to distribute £5 million in grants for couples counseling include services for gay and lesbian couples.
Australia's Senate last week passed a resolution agreeing in principle on the need for national laws to prohibit discrimination against gays and lesbians. The urgency motion by openly gay Australian Democrat Brian Gregg of West Australia read, "Given the recent public statement from both Prime Minister John Howard and opposition leader Kim Beazley expressing their opposition to discrimination against gay and lesbian people, and noting the absence of comprehensive Commonwealth laws to redress this, thus the necessity for Parliament to enact national laws against sexuality discrimination." The opposition Labour Party, Australian Democrats, and Greens passed the motion over the objections of the ruling coalition. Gregg called the resolution's passage the first expression of explicit support for gay and lesbian rights reform to pass the Senate since the Sexual Privacy Act of 1994. The political discussion as federal elections campaigns gear up has centered on equal treatment of same-gender couples, which the national government opposes. West Australia's state government last week introduced a sweeping reform bill against discrimination against gays, lesbians, and same-gender couples.
Australia's High Court this week heard oral arguments on access to fertility treatment for lesbians and other women not in relationships with men. The ruling is not expected for some months. The issue has made headlines for months since a federal court struck down Victoria's state law prohibiting fertility treatment for women not in relationships with men, finding the state law in violation of the Federal Sex Discrimination Act. The Federal Attorney General made a controversial decision to allow Australia's Catholic bishops to challenge the federal court ruling in the nation's highest court. The High Court justices were unusually critical of the Attorney General's actions in the case. One justice accused him of acting for political pressure groups rather than the public interest, while another suggested he was out to undermine the federal judicial structure. The Australian Family Association was another recognized party in the case against equal access to fertility treatment. Its submissions included extensive references to discredited anti-gay research by the U.S. religious right regarding sexually transmitted diseases, coprophilia, and bestiality. Openly gay Justice Michael Kirby was not alone in finding this material both disgusting and irrelevant, and once the Family Association's lead attorney had actually read the affidavit himself, he made a formal apology to the court. The National Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission and the Women's Electoral Lobby appeared in defense of equal access.
The government of the Australian state of Tasmania has adopted a unique 20-year plan to combat homophobia. Veteran gay activist Rodney Croom said, "This is the first time any community, anywhere in the world, has set itself the goal of eliminating abuse and harassment on the grounds of sexuality. The plan called Tasmania Together also targets other human rights issues, population, poverty, and the environment. It's modeled after efforts in Ireland and the U.S. state of Oregon, but neither of those explicitly tackled homophobia. One key element in the broad plan is for all of Tasmania's teachers to undergo anti-homophobia training by the year 2020. Another specific target is reduction of the percentage of gays and lesbians experiencing anti-gay abuse from the 44% found in 2000 to 3% in 2020. Targets will be used in developing state budgets.
Europe took further steps this week to require four nations seeking European Union membership to reform their laws toward equal treatment of gays and lesbians. In its annual review of EU applicants, the European Parliament passed resolutions calling on Bulgaria, Cyprus, Hungary, and Romania to eliminate provisions in the penal code that discriminate against homosexual men and lesbian women. Also, the EU's Enlargement Commissioner, Gunther Verhagen, told the European Parliament that, "I want to make it crystal clear that the Commission will continue to press in the enlargement negotiations for full observance of human rights and the rights of minorities. This includes a ban on any discrimination based on age, gender, sexual orientation, or religious conviction. All four countries have discriminatory ages of consent, in addition to other discriminatory criminal code sections."
There were notable demonstrations this week in Turkey and Belarus and at the United Nations World Conference Against Racism. As Turkey's Minister for Women's Affairs and the Family, Hasan Cemisi made an early morning tour of Istanbul's nightlife district to review the situation of street children. A group of transgender sex workers attacked his entourage. The minister and journalist fled into a hotel as the transgenders attacked with fists, feet, rocks, and bottles. Istanbul's transgenders have a long history of poverty, official neglect, social rejection, and police abuse. At least three of the protesters were detained by police.
But in Minsk, Belarus's first-ever transgender festival is going ahead in the wake of a gay and lesbian pride march that was successful despite its lack of official permission. While last year's Minsk Pride event was broken up by police, this week some 300 costumed demonstrators marched down the main street and rallied in front of the home of the Belarusian president. Some observers believe it was the general election pending just 2 days later that led officials to tolerate the parade.
The UN's anti-racism conference in Durban, South Africa, has been deeply divided on many issues since before it convened, and homophobia is one of them. The full name of the meeting is the World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Other Related Intolerances. Gay and lesbian activists had sought recognition of homophobia as one of those related intolerances, noting in particular that homophobia aggravates racism. Some European nations are continuing to seek a denunciation of homophobic hate crimes in the conference action plan, and UNHIV/AIDS program chief Peter Pioe called on the conference to challenge anti-gay discrimination. But the International Lesbian and Gay Association was excluded from official participation in the meeting, and members of that group and others staged what was called a small but noisy protest outside the conference center this week. One focus of the protest was the murders of 400 transgendered people in Argentina.
North America's first gay and lesbian TV channel, Toronto-based Pride Vision, began telecasting this week. Unfortunately, only the few Canadians with digital cable converters can access it, along with some U.S. residents with satellite reception. For Ontario and Points East, there's a free 3-month trial period, but Shaw, the only cable carrier for Points West, has refused to participate. Pride Vision will produce only one original weekly public affairs program for its first season, filling out its schedule with films and shows from elsewhere in Canada, the U.S., and U.K.
And finally, it's hard to imagine any gay-friendly organization honoring a military body, but it happened this week in New Zealand. Auckland's Equal Employment Opportunities Trust gave its Innovation Award to the New Zealand Navy's Sexual Orientation Support and Training Program, which started activities aboard ships in December. The Trust called it a first for any Navy in the world. That openly gay consultant Eugene Moore lived and worked alongside seagoing personnel, raising their awareness and breaking down barriers. Although officially New Zealand's ban on military service by open gays and lesbians ended in 1993, the Navy realized its leaders had continued to maintain an unofficial ban. Now, with the full commitment of senior officers, the program has hoped to improve staff retention, morale, and social interactions.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 8th, 2001, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Kelly Blanchfield.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
A civilly disobedient gay Brit takes direct action to a new level on the international scene later in the program. The city of Tampa, Florida is reconsidering its government pension rules now that the widow of a lesbian police officer killed in the line of duty is fighting for her benefits. As This Way Out's Randy Zimmerman reports, the surviving partner, who is also a policewoman, may have to carry her argument all the way to the state legislature.
Tampa Detective Mickey Mashburn is seeking the pension benefits she believes she is owed as the 10-year life partner of slain Tampa police officer Lois Marrero. Allegations that Marrero had an affair will not deter Mashburn. To date, Mashburn's request for benefits has been denied by the 8-member Police and Firefighter Pension Board. At a press conference before the pension board's decision, Mashburn explained that she's fighting for a higher cause.
And you would hope that with the support of the community and the nation at this point, that they will help us get it through the local and state laws, hopefully. I just want the pension to look at everything, try to look at it as a couple that was married and that lived together and have the same understanding that they would any other couple.
On July 6th, Officer Marrero was shot and killed during an attempted bank robbery. She was the first woman in the Tampa police force to be killed in the line of duty. Marrero did not leave a will, but did name Mickey Mashburn as the beneficiary of her city life insurance policy. Mashburn additionally contends that her relationship with Marrero was like a marriage, and she should be entitled to death benefits as any other widow, a sum that would pay Mashburn $28,000 a year for the rest of her life. In Tampa, as in the rest of Florida, only people in legally recognized marriages are considered spouses. The law is clear. Setting up house, sharing household expenses, and exchanging vows of commitment in front of friends and relatives don't count if you're in a gay or lesbian relationship. Marrero and Mashburn held a commitment ceremony 10 years ago, a practice common in the lesbian and gay community because marriage is not an option. Mashburn's attorney, Karen Deering, explains how the existing Tampa pension plan violates the Florida Civil Rights Act.
The Florida Civil Rights Act requires that an employer not discriminate against its employees based on marital status, among other categories. The pension plan, as currently constituted, provides a greater benefit for married employees than it does to its employees who are either unmarried or in relationships that are not currently recognized. So from a legal perspective as well, the city pension plan needs to be changed to fully comply with the Florida Civil Rights Act.
Marrero's family and Mashburn sat together at Lois's funeral, which received full police honors. However, Marrero's family says Lois would not have wanted Mashburn to receive the benefits because Lois was seeing another woman living in Texas. Mashburn's motives have also been questioned. At the moment, she's on limited duty because of an injury she sustained off-duty 2 years ago. If Mashburn cannot pass the minimum physical requirements for a police officer, she could be fired. Karen Deering says none of these charges have any bearing on the case.
That has no relevance to the case, and what this is about is Mickey and Lois's relationship and the fact that they were married, they were committed to each other, and that this is what Lois would have wanted.
While not dealing directly with the issue of gay and lesbian relationships, a special committee is now studying whether or not to change the way the pension provision is written. Where the pension benefits read widow or widower, the committee will now consider allowing police officers and firefighters to name a specific beneficiary. The involved unions would have to approve the change, then the full city council, and finally, the state legislature. I'm Randy Zimmerman in Tampa, Florida, for This Way Out.
Hey, this is Tom Robinson reminding you that you're either listening to, discovering for the first time, or tuned right in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
As we discovered on last week's This Way Out, British activist Peter Tatchell plans to make his third attempt to arrest arrest Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe when the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, or CHOGM, gathers in Brisbane, Australia in early October. Tatchell's controversial direct action demonstrations have become almost as well known around the world as Mugabe's homophobic outbursts. But as John Frame of Queer Radio notes in this interview with Tatchell, the Gay Human Rights Campaigner's association with the regime in Zimbabwe was not always adversarial.
You were actually involved in getting Mugabe's party, perhaps, into power. You were campaigning for liberation from white domination within Zimbabwe.
When I was a student in London in the 1970s, I was involved in supporting the Zimbabwe freedom struggle against white minority rule. In those days, Ian Smith was effectively a white dictator. You know, there were incredible human rights abuses going on inside Zimbabwe in order to preserve white minority rule. I 100% supported the struggle of black and white Zimbabweans to create a democratic multiracial society where there would be human rights for all. Now, Robert Mugabe in those days stood for those principles. He too was committed to democracy and human rights. But of course, like so many people, when he came to power, after a honeymoon period when he did a lot of very good, positive things, he very quickly slipped into the routine abuse of human rights. And we saw that with the incredible, horrific massacres of political opponents in Matabeleland during the 1980s, when up to 20,000 people were massacred by his troops. And we've seen it ever since in the suppression of strikes and peaceful protests, the intimidation of journalists and judges, and of course a whole spate of politically motivated killings and tortures.
Enough people have actually said to me, well, you know, what have gay men got to do with CHOGM? Why are they putting their nose in there? And aside from the Mugabe issue, gay men are affected by other issues, like human rights issues.
Just recently, the officers of Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, the main queer rights pressure group in Harare, were vandalized and daubed with graffiti. Members of GALS have been threatened with death unless they leave the country. These are pretty extreme things to do against people who are harming no one and who are simply seeking dignity, respect, and human rights. But of course, this is just part of a pattern of wider human rights abuses where all sections of civil society are under attack by the Mugabe regime. And most of the people victimized were black Zimbabweans.
Some people may wonder whether you actually have the right to arrest Mugabe here in Brisbane. Like, is there any law that's actually applicable in Australia, perhaps, that says that you can arrest him here?
There is no international human rights law against homophobia or which would allow for the arrest of government leaders who persecute lesbians and gay men. But there is a law against torture. It's the United Nations Convention Against Torture, 1984, which Australia, Britain, and most other countries have signed, ratified, and pledged to uphold. That's the legal basis on which I'll be seeking to get the Australian authorities to arrest President Mugabe when he comes to Brisbane for the Commonwealth Summit. I've got the evidence that he has condoned or acquiesced in torture. When presented with that evidence, those signed affidavits, I believe the Australian authorities will have an obligation to put him under arrest and put him on trial. I don't know whether they will, but I know that that is what the law says. So I'm coming to Brisbane as the law enforcer. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get the Australian government to enforce the law against torture that it has signed.
Your style of activism, you've written a book, in fact, The Art of Activism, Protest as Performance. It's obvious, it's the way that you feel compelled to work with the world and to achieve change. But it's also what concerns people, like who perhaps see what you're doing as being perhaps making life for people around you dangerous. But you have a situation where I was reading perhaps in Gay Times that you have to lock your house up like a fortress, practically with steel shutters, because your house will be vandalized when you're known not to be home. You have trouble like walking down the street because everyone recognizes you. Anyone who thinks that you deserve a thump is likely to act on that. How do you cope in general with that sort of life?
I think my confrontational style direct action is not a measure of first resort. It's always been a question of last resort. You know, I've tried the calm, moderate way of doing things, negotiating, lobbying, letter writing, being polite, being respectable and reasonable. And it's only when that doesn't work that I've resorted to nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, to push the case for gay and other human rights. And I think, to me, that is part and parcel of the way things have always worked throughout history. You know, every great movement for social justice has at certain points had to resort to direct action in order to get their issues on the political agenda. When I began with Mugabe, I didn't start with direct action. I wrote him a polite, considered letter. In fact, I wrote him several polite, considered letters. I even wrote to some of his colleagues who I'd known from the days of the Liberation War. It was only when they refused to listen to reason and argument and compassion, it's only then that I resorted to direct action. And you're absolutely right. This has brought on me, you know, a monstrous cycle of violence and intimidation as well. Yeah, my home is a fortress because I'm subjected to regular targeted attacks by homophobes and neo-Nazi terrorist groups who don't like the fact that I'm standing up for gay rights and black rights and other human rights that they object to. So for me, life is very difficult, and I wouldn't deny for one minute that it does create a lot of personal problems and angst. You know, it's not nice living under a virtual state of siege, never knowing when you might get the next bomb or bullet or knife or iron bar as you leave your apartment. But I guess, you know, as much as I dislike living like this, I'm resigned to the fact that it is a necessary, you know, price to pay in order to push forward the agenda for universal human rights.
Your attempted arrest earlier this year of Mugabe in Belgium, the footage for that has been replayed on television here in the news over the last couple of weeks, lots of times. And a good thing is that I think it's the secretary for the Federal Liberal Party, has been calling for Mugabe to be banned from entry to the country. And they've been showing that footage, and he's been saying, well, here's an example of how someone who was doing a right thing got horribly abused. But that's just, as he says, that's an introduction to what Mugabe's about. Mugabe's the sort of person we don't want to have in our country, not just because we don't want this sort of violence, but because we don't want him being acknowledged as being a good person. So it has been worthwhile getting that amount of press.
When I went to Brussels to try and arrest him in March, I didn't even know whether I'd get anywhere near him because I was acting on an anonymous tip-off about his possible schedule. So I jumped on a plane at 24 hours notice, flew over there, and did it all on the hop, you know. It was all ad-lib. But I am pleased because I know that from inside Zimbabwe, although what I did was actually quite insignificant and really merely symbolic, inside Zimbabwe, the reaction from grassroots people, black and white, gay and straight, was so phenomenally positive. It gave people a real psychological boost that someone had taken on this dictator, that someone had dared to challenge him, to stop him while he was swanning around on the world stage, posing as this respectable elder statesman. Now, often politics and protest is about symbols, and I am gratified that what I did and, you know, what inadvertently happened to me, being knocked unconscious by his bodyguard, I'm gratified that that did help expose the brutality of his regime and add to the argument why he is an international pariah, and why his regime should be subjected to international sanctions.
Yep. If people went to your website, we'll give them your web address.
It's www.petertatchell.net.
Easy.
Yeah, so it's www.petertatchell, all one word, .net.
There are a huge number of issues that are there showing that a queer man, really, there's a lot more that's important than just who he's having sex with. There's a lot more that's important to your life.
Yeah, I think what I've been trying to do is to integrate queer rights into a broader human rights agenda and in some ways make the queer agenda the human rights agenda and to break down these barriers between gay and straight, to recognize our common humanity. And I suppose that's what motivates me in this campaign to have Mugabe arrested. Mm-hmm. It isn't just his abuses of gay human rights. It's his abuse of all human rights. You know, we are all part of the same human family, whatever our sexuality or race. And, you know, we have an obligation in the West to not wash our hands of what is happening in Africa, but to recognize that our African brothers and sisters are part of the same human family. And just as we would want others to defend us if our human rights were being abused, we have a moral duty to defend those, even in faraway countries, even in completely different cultures. We have an obligation to defend them and help them and show them solidarity.
That was Queer Radio's John Frame speaking with activist Peter Tatchell in London. Tatchell welcomed the news last week that the Australian government will not bar President Mugabe from entering the country, saying that the next step should be to arrest Mugabe when he arrives. The Zimbabwe Standard reports that Mugabe is beefing up his security force for the trip. Meanwhile, the Australian gay and lesbian rights group Queers Against Corporate Exploitation has announced its intention to bring 200 protesters to join other demonstrators at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Kelly Blanchfield, Graham Underhill, Chris Ambidge, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Rex Wagner, Randy Zimmerman, and John Frame contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on multimedia, then on radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For an urgent message about This Way Out's critical financial situation, please visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on WERU Blue Hill Falls, Maine, CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.